The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine here at the North Carolina Reading Service. And today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that's GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 21/June 28, 2021. It has the usual red border on the front cover. The background today is green, somewhere between teal green and forest green, rather dark or medium dark. Even darker green are the large block letters that spell out time on the upper portion of the page. The headline in bright white block lettering says, "We'll never be the same. The innovation boom, therapy without the couch, how to prevent the next pandemic." There's a mask, a white mask, as those that we have been wearing during the pandemic are reminiscent of. And within the mask, there's a bit of a clutter, although it's in a vertical format. We see microscopes. We see people with stethoscopes. We see other people pushing other people in wheelchairs. Someone's giving someone else a vaccination shot in his or her right arm. Another one's getting another shot in another right arm. More wheelchairs, more people, more clipboards with crosses on them, more small vials as if to contain vaccine, more stethoscopes, and person leaning on a cane, and other things that look like blobs, which may be the virus in some kind of graphic mode. Moving to the first article entitled The Brief, under which we see Nation, Biden takes on Putin, by Brian Bennett. There's a photo here, a full-page photo of President Joe Biden descending the steps, presumably of Air Force One. It's an airplane stairway with a red carpet on it. He's dressed in dark blue, a suit, a dark blue tie, a blue and white striped shirt. He has a lapel pin on his left suit lapel, probably a tiny U.S. flag. It's hard to see from here. He's got black shoes. I can see his shoes. And then we see the railing of the staircase. And then above that, the rest of his self, his frame. He's neither smiling nor frowning. It's a bit of a somewhat grin, I think. His white hair is short. He's wearing aviator-type sunglasses. The brief opener. Vladimir Putin spent much of 2020 orchestrating a brazen influence campaign to stop Joe Biden from becoming the 46th president of the United States. Failing at that, the Russian autocrat spent the first 5 months of Biden's term presiding over a series of attacks by criminal organizations and state-led agencies against America's gas and food supplies at home and its allies and values abroad. The unspoken question facing the U.S. president when he sits down with Putin June 16 in a lakeside hotel in Geneva is this: what are you going to do about it? Taking a page from America's successful decades-long strategy against the Soviet Union, Biden's planning to rally allies at the G7 summit in the UK and at the NATO confab in Belgium to present a united front against Moscow. Biden's 8-day foreign trip, his first as president, was originally planned as a sedate expedition to reconnect with old friends and discuss strategies for managing climate change and China's global rise. But the recent ransomware attack on Colonial Pipeline and JBS Foods meat processing plants, allegedly by criminal hackers acting with Moscow's tacit approval, changed the calculation, says a senior Biden administration official. These guys are running wild, and they think Biden can be taken advantage of. Now Biden's preparing to get tough when he sits down in Geneva with Putin. For the first time as president, among the moves he and his team have weighed to show he means business, reminding Putin the U.S. has its own cyber abilities and can target Putin's personal overseas fortunes. Biden hopes to amplify both threats by speaking for U.S. allies as well, and to back Putin down from these provocations. The whole goal is to have Putin coming away saying, "The Americans are on to us and have us encircled," the official says. It won't be easy. Putin's played a weak hand well. Russia's commodity-based economy's been stagnating, and that in turn has fed seething discontent. That may be incentive for raising Russia's profile abroad, exploiting U.S. missteps in the Middle East, and the chaos Donald Trump created in the U.S. and abroad. Putin's wielded Russia's expertise in cyber warfare and disinformation to launch asymmetric attacks against his opponents in Europe and the U.S. Biden's mission in Geneva is not about a personal test of wills. It is about halting this risky escalation and getting the U.S. and Russia back on stable footing, administration officials say. No two countries have more nuclear missiles ready to launch than Russia and the U.S. Under Trump, key treaties between the nations and lines of communication fell into disuse. What is glaringly missing and dangerous, and what was decimated under Trump, was work on strategic stability, says a senior State Department official. We have lost all these treaties that were designed to keep this stuff locked down. 10 years ago, things looked a lot different. In March 2011, Biden traveled to Moscow to meet with Putin, who had temporarily stepped aside as president and was holding the title of prime minister. Biden, there to foster closer ties with Russia as vice president, said he wanted to encourage business between the nations as part of the ongoing push to reset relations. Quoting a Russia-based Boeing official, Biden said during a meeting, "Russia has the best engineers in the world. Russia has intellectual capital. Russia is a great nation." Since then, Russia has annexed Crimea, poisoned dissidents with chemical weapons, expanded a proxy war in Syria, meddled in two U.S. elections, and stepped up its cyber offensives. Diplomatic and consular channels between the countries have withered. Russia says it will permanently cut off local hires at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow by August in retaliation for U.S. sanctions over Russia's 2020 election interference and involvement in the massive SolarWinds cyberattack, which siphoned off sensitive data from U.S. federal government computers and major global companies. By March 2021, when an ABC News interviewer asked if he thinks Putin is a killer, Biden bluntly said, "I do." Part of what's made Putin's aggression so hard for the U.S. to counter is his use of cyber criminals. Accused Russian hackers, like those who took down the Colonial Pipeline computers for 6 days in May, sparking East Coast fuel shortages, may not have acted directly at the behest of Moscow, but often work with its implicit approval, U.S. officials say. When JBS Foods was hacked in late May, the FBI tracked it to one of many criminal networks operating with impunity in Russia. Striking back carries its own risks. Russia has more experience in cyber war and has penetrated U.S. government and electrical grid networks. We might lose an escalation, says the senior Biden administration official. There's also the matter of Russia's nuclear arsenal, a growing portion of which is not covered by any nuclear treaty. Only one of several Cold War treaties governing U.S. and Russian nuclear stockpiles remains in effect. Biden renewed that agreement, called New START, February 3, but only for 5 years. This is one domain where they are America's equal, says Samuel Sharup, a former State Department official and senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Although Biden's planning to talk tough in Geneva, the goal is to ease tensions and establish predictability on both sides by reining in Putin's adventurism. Much of Biden's preparation, three senior administration officials say, has taken place during his daily intelligence briefing. The leading figure there has been CIA Director William Burns, a former U.S. ambassador to Moscow who worked for Secretary of State James Baker during the collapse of the Soviet Union. Burns and others advocate a return to the Cold War containment of Moscow's moves. Everywhere Putin goes, he must meet resistance, the senior administration official says. Biden's qualified to lead the approach. He spent decades in debates on U.S.-Russian relations as a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and as VP. Asked how much time the president has spent preparing for the trip, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said he's been getting ready for 50 years. In the end, that may be Biden's clearest advantage as he faces Putin once again. When George W. Bush invited Putin to his Texas ranch after becoming president in 2001, Bush said he trusted Putin and he was able to get a sense of his soul. Biden has seen more of Putin over the past 20 years, and he does not trust him. In fact, Biden said earlier this year, he too has looked into Putin's eyes and does not think he has a soul. Putin's retort, Biden told ABC, was that the men understand each other. Heading into a tense summit, there are worse places to start. Brian Bennett is the primary writer of this article, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Alejandro de la Garza, New York, and Massimo Calabresi, Washington. The photograph I earlier described was by Evan Vucci. The Risk Report, more on the same subject. This is by Ian Bremmer, and entitled, What Game Is Putin Playing? Vladimir Putin's pumping some last-minute iron and putting finishing touches on his trademark smirk as Joe Biden preps for his first face-to-face with the Russian president since taking office in Geneva, June 16. For Putin, this meeting's a big deal. It's a chance to sit opposite the man who leads Russia's greatest nemesis, the U.S., he can smile for the cameras as an equal, bat away subjects like the fate of imprisoned opposition activist Alexei Navalny, and cyber attacks on the U.S. that he does not want to discuss, and defiantly insist on Russia's view of the world. For Biden, there are fewer interesting opportunities. He will not get to Putin until he's met with the allies at the G7 summit in what he hopes will be a triumphant return of U.S. leadership to the Western alliance. The tougher questions for Biden will be kept behind closed doors, and smiles will prevail before the cameras. Putin will not be there, of course, because Russia's annexation of Crimea led to Russia's expulsion from G7 summits, despite Donald Trump's best efforts to re-include him. When Biden finally sits down with Putin, his mind's likely to wander toward the rising power that both Democrats and Republicans consider the most important American adversary. It is China, not Russia, that poses the greatest challenge to U.S. power and prosperity. China's the growing technological power. China, not Russia, has genuinely global influence and is far more important for the future of the U.S. economy. Russia is still contending with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia can meddle in Ukraine at the margins, but threats to fully invade and occupy a country of more than 44 million people are not credible. That big a move would cost too many Russian lives and too many rubles for a chronically weak and weakening Russian economy. In recent months, Belarus provided the latest example of the post-Soviet demand for fundamental change and the need to shoot people to keep protests under control. In the most recent presidential election in Moldova, a Harvard-educated economist toppled a pro-Kremlin incumbent. Last year, Turkey's backing for Azerbaijan dealt a humiliating defeat to Russian ally Armenia in a region Russia once dominated. Beijing's increasingly competing for influence with Moscow among the former Soviet Central Asian states. Nor is Russia stronger these days within its own borders. Its economy's covered in rust. Despite years of warning that climate change fears and rising investment in green energy would make heavy dependence for growth and revenue on hydrocarbons an increasingly bad bet, Russia has not changed course. When oil prices surged from 2001 to 2008, its economy expanded by 6.6% per year. From 2012 to 2019, as oil prices fell in response to a production surge in the U.S., growth fell to about 1% per year. The COVID-19 pandemic only made matters worse. Yet oil and gas still account for more than 60% of exports and about 40% of state revenue. Russia's interventionist foreign policy, particularly in the Middle East, and its nuclear weapons make it easy to forget Russia's economy is smaller than Canada's and just over half the size of California's. That is not to say Russia cannot make trouble for the U.S., particularly in cyberspace. The two governments target each other as a matter of routine, but a rash of ransomware and other hacking attacks by Russian organized crime on U.S. companies is a growing cause for concern. Russian criminal groups are suspected in recent attacks on the world's largest meat packer and the largest U.S. fuel pipeline. Biden administration officials have made clear Biden will raise the issue forcefully with Putin. But the administration wants a more stable and more predictable relationship with Russia, according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. That is why last month the U.S. President ordered the waiving of sanctions on a company building a controversial Russian gas pipeline to Europe, and why the White House wants this meeting with Putin. These moves are meant to encourage Putin to create fewer nuisances that distract Biden and U.S. allies in Europe from the more fundamental challenge posed by China, at a time when, according to Biden's senior Asia advisor, Kurt Campbell, the era of engagement with China is over. Biden gets fewer Russian headaches and Russia gets more economic relief. But do not expect Biden and Putin to pretend they like each other. In March, Biden affirmed to a television interviewer he thinks Putin's a killer. Putin responded with the diplomatic equivalent of, "I know you are, but what am I?" and recalled his ambassador from Washington. Earlier this month, Putin trolled the U.S. over the January 6 attacks on the Capitol to accuse its leaders of hypocrisy as they criticize crackdowns on protests in other countries. Biden will hit the subjects he plans to raise and meet Putin's diffidence, shrug for shrug. But if Putin can get his photo op sitting opposite his fifth U.S. president and score a few style points, he might have something to offer Biden in exchange for an easing of economic pressure on his government. Maybe a promise to continue to seek a diplomatic solution on Ukraine, or a cyber announcement that remains in effect until the next time U.S.-Russian relations head south. Ian Bremmer, who wrote this column, is a Time columnist and president of the Eurasia Group. There are two more photos within this article. One is dated 2011, and that's when Biden met Putin in Moscow to push a reset of relations. That's when Biden would have been vice president. What's interesting to me is these two are shaking hands, both wearing dark suits, white shirts, and blue ties. Biden already has his short-cropped white hair. He's standing in front of a flag, though it's not the U.S. flag, which is in the middle of the photo where the hands are being shaken. And Mr. Putin, across from Mr. Biden, has reddish, brownish, blondish hair. Now, here's a new photo from June 4 of Putin speaking at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, June 4. I don't know if Mr. Putin's speaking remotely, but his face is huge on a screen which is being watched by a few people seated in what appear to be armchairs. They appear to be men with a woman walking across a stage. The table between the men, there are three that I can see, has beverage drinks, some tablets, maybe electronic notebooks, and a lovely vase of white hydrangeas, with Mr. Putin's head looming large in the background on what is presumably a large screen. And there his hair is gray. Now, for the record, this is a one-page summary of short items. I don't know if we'll ever see eye to eye on that day, said Mike Pence, former vice president, in a June 3 speech discussing his and former President Donald Trump's differing perceptions of the January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. 2. The number of years former U.S. President Donald Trump will remain suspended from Facebook starting January 7, 2021, according to a June 4 announcement by the social media platform. She is more than we could have ever imagined, spoken by Prince Harry and Meghan Markle in a June 6 statement, announcing the birth of their second child, Lily Diana, 2 days earlier. 7, the number of national women's all-around titles now held by gymnast Simone Biles after her win June 6, the most by any American woman. The greatest adventure with my best friend, stated by Jeff Bezos, who announced June 7 he and his brother will travel to space in July aboard a rocket made by his company, Blue Origin. Here the big ships are again. It's shameful, said Tommaso Cacciari, leader of a Venetian protest group, in a June 3 interview as the first cruise ship docked in the city's port, despite a March promise by the Italian government to bar the landings. 50% increase in carbon dioxide in the world's air since the start of the Industrial Age, measured at its annual spring peak, per scientists, June 7. Carbon dioxide traps heat. Good news of the week, citing their impact on marginalized communities, Ally Financial, June 2, became the first major U.S. bank to confirm it will stop charging customers overdraft fees. Because you represent the best of your generation, we wish to give you a fresh start, said by Alfred Anthony Pinkard, Wilberforce University president, announcing in a May 29 speech at the HBCU's graduation ceremony that 2020 and 2021 graduates, two graduating years, would have their student loans cleared. Here's the brief news. A photo. It looks like a windswept Martian landscape, but there is a beautiful horizon with blue skies and fluffy white clouds in the background. A grayish plume of smoke, though, near the horizon. And in the foreground, the soil looks from back to front dark gray, white, medium gray, red, dark, or medium gray, and then dark gray again. Upon the closest medium gray strata stand four people. Some look like they're dressed in hazmat suits, the white, plasticky-looking coveralls with hoods and boots. And then one more individual is dressed in black and bright blue, almost a Star Trek kind of outfit. We see only their backs in this photo. The caption reads, written by Madeline Carlisle, Sri Lankan Navy personnel clear potentially toxic materials and plastic pellets from a beach near Colombo, May 27. After a cargo ship roughly 9 nautical miles offshore caught fire a week earlier, shipping containers have fallen into the sea as the ship began to sink. And given that it contains a hazardous cargo that includes fuel, oil, and nitric acid, experts warn of an environmental disaster if the vessel is not stabilized. This next column is under the world caption, the hardliner poised to become Iran's president. And this entire column of four short items is written by Dan Stewart. Iran will vote on its new president June 18, although many Iranians are criticizing the election's results as a foregone conclusion. A powerful unelected council has disqualified the majority of candidates from running, leaving conservative cleric Ebrahim Raisi, the favored choice of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, as the clear frontrunner. Illusion of choice, Raisi, 60, is the country's chief judge and a close ally of Khamenei's. Both hail from the northeast city of Mashhad. He lost the 2017 election to Hassan Rouhani, who is not eligible to stand for re-election again because of term limits, and Iran's power brokers are taking no chances this time around. Few reformist candidates were permitted to run, and Raisi's six remaining rivals are far less well known. Turnout's expected to be minuscule, as many Iranians have pledged to boycott the ballot boxes. On Twitter, a meme has circulated showing Raisi debating six versions of himself. International reputation. Human rights groups point to Raisi's bloody record presiding over the extrajudicial executions of thousands of political prisoners in the 1980s. Yet despite a reputation as a hardliner, Raisi is expected to oversee continued negotiations with the U.S. over a new deal to limit Iran's nuclear ambitions. The imperative is primarily financial. Under the Trump administration's sanctions, Iran's economy is in tatters, with inflation at close to 40%. Stepping stone. The presidency is widely seen as Raisi's internship for an even greater position, that of supreme leader. And Raisi, whose name I hopefully am pronouncing correctly, is spelled R-A-I-S-I. Now in his 80s, Khamenei was himself president when he took the top job in 1989. Raisi was entrusted with a religious foundation worth billions of dollars and could get a political promotion to Ayatollah, as Khamenei did. His task as president will be to strengthen his power base within the Revolutionary Guards, guarantors of the regime who shape much of Iran's security, military, and foreign policy. From the news ticker, three short items here. Germany recognizes tribal genocide. Germany has formally recognized colonial-era atrocities in Namibia, referring to the massacres of the Herero and Nama people in the early 20th century as genocide, May 28, and pledging financial aid worth more than $1.34 billion over the next 30 years. Harris tells migrants, do not come. During a two-day trip to Guatemala and Mexico intended to address the root causes of Central American migration to the U.S., Vice President Kamala Harris said in a June 8 speech that Central American migrants should not come to the U.S.-Mexico border, drawing the ire of progressive immigration activists. Four Muslims dead in Canada, hate crime. A man's been accused of murdering four members of a Canadian Muslim family in Ontario by running them over with his truck, an incident Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called a terrorist attack. Police said Nathaniel Veltman intentionally mounted a curb while driving, striking a family of five, June 4. More briefs from the news ticker. Three more. Manchin, M-A-N-C-H-I-N, blocks voting rights bill. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, West Virginia, said June 6 he would not vote for the For the People Act, a major Democrat-backed bill to combat voter suppression, because it lacks Republican support. He also pledged again to preserve the chamber's filibuster, imperiling the prospects of many of Democrats' more ambitious plans. Nigeria bans Twitter over deleted tweet. Nigeria blocked Twitter June 4 after the company removed a tweet by President Muhammadu Buhari threatening regional secessionists whom he blames for attacks on government offices. Twitter users in Nigeria have condemned the ban. Many are bypassing restrictions by using virtual private networks. G7 approves Biden's global tax plan. Finance ministers from the G7 nations announced June 5 their collective support for a U.S. proposed plan to make the global minimum tax rate for multinational companies at least 15%. And agreed, major corporations should pay taxes in countries where they generate sales. Again, under the brief news, good question. Why is FDA approval of an Alzheimer's drug controversial? This article is written by Alice Park. More than 100 years after Dr. Alois Alzheimer first described the brain disorder that would be named after him, the world has its first treatment for the disease. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, approved aducanumab, that's A-D-U-C-A-N-U-M-A-B, June 7, after a contentious review that still has the Alzheimer's community divided over how effective and therefore how useful the drug will be. Developed by U.S.-based biotech company Biogen and Japanese pharmaceutical company Eisai, aducanumab is the first treatment to address one of the underlying causes of Alzheimer's, the buildup of amyloid protein plaques in the brain. But while the data that Biogen submitted from two large clinical trials showed the drug reduces amyloid levels among those getting the once-a-month IV infusions, the studies were less clear about how much that amyloid reduction translates into improvement in cognitive function. One study showed improvement in patients' memory and recall, while the other showed no benefit. Biogen scientists say that in the latter study, some people received an inadequate dose, impacting the results. That is why the FDA is requiring Biogen to conduct a new study, comparing people randomly assigned to get the drug or a placebo, to confirm that aducanumab does indeed improve cognitive skills. with the possibility that approval will be withdrawn if it does not. We are happy to be doing this trial to verify what we think we saw in previous trials, says Dr. Alfred Sandrock, head of research and development at Biogen, because there are questions out there. Even aside from those critical questions about clinical benefit are concerns about cost and access to the drug. Biogen estimates aducanumab will cost about $56,000 per patient per year, with many patients needing to continue receiving the treatment for years. And because it's an IV infusion, patients will need to get aducanumab at doctor's offices or infusion centers. They will also need to be monitored for potential brain inflammation, which can be a side effect. Given these issues, doctors say it's important to set realistic expectations for what the drug can and cannot do. For some Alzheimer's patients who are early enough in the disease's process, it could help slow the cognitive decline that can be so devastating for them and their loved ones. But for others, it might not be worth risking any side effects. It is incumbent on all of us as doctors to behave responsibly in selecting the right patients, discussing the risks and benefits, and following them for a sufficient amount of time to see if they are benefiting, says Dr. Ronald Peterson, director of the Mayo Clinic Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. This is not the penicillin for Alzheimer's disease, but it is a component of stepping in the right direction to treating the disease, and I think so. Nature, animal instincts. There's a photo here of a rat. It's a cute little grayish brownish furry animal with little pink paws. It's standing on something that looks like the edge of a wooden, I don't know, step or railing. It's wearing a little medal. It has a little blue harness on from which is dangling a little gold medal. This item's written by Suyin Haynes. Magawa, M-A-G-A-W-A, an African giant pouched rat credited as one of the most successful rodents trained to find landmines, is retiring after 5 years of dangerous work. He has helped save many lives, Magawa's trainer told the BBC, but slowing down in old age. Here are some more heroic animal feats, but the photo has an additional caption. The medal-winning Magawa detected 71 landmines and dozens more unexploded items in Cambodia. Okay, more heroic animal feats. Pigeon power. Despite being shot en route, U.S. Army Signal Corps carrier pigeon Cherami delivered a message that saved nearly 200 American troops' lives in France during World War I. Cherami was later awarded the French Croix de Guerre Medal for extraordinary bravery. Canine clones. A German Shepherd sniffer dog working with a Canadian canine police unit, Tracker, T-R-A-K-R, successfully led research workers to the last survivor found in the ruins of the World Trade Center after the 9/11 attacks. In 2009, a California company cloned 5 puppies based on Tracker's DNA. And finally, from the animal column, Bear, B-E-A-R, Battalion. During World War II, Polish soldiers bought and adopted a Syrian brown bear cub, naming him Wojtek, or Wojtek. It's spelled W-O-J-T-E-K. He was later officially drafted into the Polish army, where he buoyed morale and, by some reports, assisted his company by carrying heavy artillery shells. Under the milestones column, which is a page long, exhumed Nathan Bedford Forest. That's F-O-R-R-E-S-T, A Win in the Fight Against White Supremacy, by Tammy Sawyer, who is County Commissioner for Shelby County, Tennessee, as told to Sonia Mansour. It took decades. Tennessee's black residents have long demanded the removal of a statue and the remains of Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate general, slave trader, and Ku Klux Klan leader from a city park in Memphis, where I grew up. This is again by Tammy Sawyer, as told to Sonia Mansour. Although earlier protests led to authorities removing his statue in 2017, it is only as of June 1 that Forrest's remains are being exhumed. I have always said if we could make the changes needed to remove these statues, we can make the changes needed to fight structural inequities. This was a win that not only changed the physical landscape of my city, but also in a lot of ways its spirit. I've been receiving threats as long as I've been doing this work, pictures of me with a noose around my neck, messages telling me my parents are going to find my body floating in the Mississippi River. I recently pressed charges against a volunteer with the Sons of Confederate Veterans, a group involved with the exhumation process. He started threatening me while holding a Confederate flag and singing Dixieland as I made a press statement. Still, it's vindicating to know black people in Memphis are going to be celebrating on Juneteenth in a park no longer named after one of the most notorious Confederate leaders. We still have a lot to fight systematically, but when I drive past the park now, I smile. I feel freer. There's a sense of closure. For me, this moment is a deep breath, the end of a chapter. There's a photo here of a large, probably granite or some kind of other stone. It's grayish. It's big. It's a big rectangular structure, rather tall, as tall as a small tree next to it. It doesn't give the footage. It's surrounded by the orange traffic cones, and the caption reads, "The plinth on which Forrest's statue once stood in what is now Health Sciences Park in Memphis." The statue's gone from the photograph. Legalized. We're still in the milestones category here. Legalized. El Salvador goes Bitcoin. El Salvador became the world's first country to make Bitcoin legal tender June 8, as its legislative assembly backed a proposal by President Nayib Bukele. In the coming months, Salvadorans will be able to use cryptocurrency to pay for goods and services and even settle tax bills alongside the U.S. dollar, which the country adopted in 2001. The government will guarantee convertibility between the currencies at the exchange rate at the time of a transaction. Bukele, that's B-U-K-E-L-E, 39, is a controversial leader. A series of recent moves to bring many levers of state power under his control have raised concern among the international community. His campaign for Bitcoin has also been divisive. Bukele argues adopting the digital currency will bring financial inclusion, investment, tourism, innovation, and economic development to El Salvador, affording unbanked people access to financial services and allowing remittances, which make up around 20% of the country's GDP, to be sent more easily and securely. Critics say the move exposes El Salvador to fluctuations in Bitcoin's value, which has proved volatile. It will also likely complicate discussions with the IMF, from which El Salvador is seeking a $1 billion funding program. That article was written by Ciara Nugent. Now, more milestones here in the left-hand column, 2, 4, 6, 7, very short items. Died David Dushman, the last surviving Soviet Red Army soldier who helped liberate the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp, June 5, at 98. Discovered, a shackled male skeleton dating from as early as the 3rd century, a likely indicator of slavery in Roman Britain, British archaeologists confirmed June 3. Recovered. Most of the $4.4 million ransom a U.S. fuel pipeline operator paid in Bitcoin to hackers in May after a cyber attack, the U.S. Justice Department said June 7. Ended. The E! Reality TV show Keeping Up with the Kardashians, June 10, after 20 seasons and 14 years on the air. Amended China's family planning policy, May 31, to allow married couples to have 3 children in an attempt to address the nation's aging population. Slapped French President Emmanuel Macron by a man in a crowd Macron was addressing during a visit to the region of Drôme, June 8. Resumed. Free samples at Costco warehouses across the U.S. in early June, the big box chain announced May 27. The practice was suspended 14 months ago because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The View, below the Nation subtitle, Who Made Juneteenth? By Janelle Ross. If you ask black people born and raised on the island, Juneteenth marks the day black soldiers in blue uniforms came with their guns to Galveston. That's the story they've told for generations about the moment some of their ancestors knew freedom had finally arrived in Texas, the westernmost Confederate breakaway state. That's the truth, as it is widely understood by black people in Galveston, even if the common story of that day often focuses on a single white man, General Gordon Granger, who led Union troops to the harbor there June 17, 1865. 2 days later, records in the National Archives tell us, he issued what's known as General Order No. 3. In doing so, Granger laid out the meaning of freedom more explicitly than any U.S. government official had to that date, says Robert C. Connor, author of General Gordon Granger, the Savior of Chickamauga, and the man behind Juneteenth. The order declared absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves. As word spread, so did jubilation, shock, religious awe, and anger. Declaring freedom and creating it are two different things, says Deborah Evans, Secretary and Director of Communications with the National Juneteenth Observance Foundation, tells me. After all, Granger was there because, though the Emancipation Proclamation had liberated the enslaved in the Confederate States, slaveholders in places like faraway Texas still clung to the idea that U.S. law did not apply to them. Among the black and white troops who came to Galveston to enforce the Union's dictates was William Costley, who with his 2 sisters and mother had been the first enslaved people freed by a then newly minted lawyer named Abraham Lincoln in 1841. The KKK would try to burn certain records of that case, and portions of his service records went up in flames thanks to another KKK faction. Costley himself was likely illiterate, says Carl Adams, who wrote the book Nance about Costley's mother's fight for freedom. Whatever the young soldier felt in Texas has, like so much that happens to those whose lives are not thought worth recording, been lost. The story of William Costley, the baby freed by Lincoln, who grew up to set others free, like the story of Juneteenth, cannot be told fully without oral tradition. Yes, newspaper accounts of organized black public revelry and white enmity survive, but so too in some circles have folk stories attesting that some of the black soldiers in Galveston that day changed history by insisting Granger make clear the freedom of those still enslaved. If he didn't do it, the story goes, they would do it themselves. My grandmother's grandmother was a child made free that June day, however it happened, but black people have always been involved in the fight to make our own American lives, demanding something of the country that stole so much from us. That fact is, by folktale and firm record, key to the Juneteenth story. Last year, Juneteenth came to an America awakened to racial injustice, prompting new groups to recognize a holiday heretofore celebrated mostly by black people with Texas connections. This year, it's a reminder of the fight. A Senate bill to make Juneteenth a federal holiday failed in 2020 by one vote. This year, a similar bill has yet to have a preliminary hearing date set, but among those on the Judiciary Committee who can cast a vote to send it to the floor is John Ossoff, a Georgia Democrat whose election this year helped flip the Senate. His victory's been widely attributed to the organizing power and electoral force of the black vote. 2 days after that first Juneteenth, the New York Herald published a dispatch from Macon, Georgia, whose white citizens finally saw that slavery is dead and nothing remains but to bury its carcass. Abraham Lincoln was gone by then, but he probably would have liked General Order No. 3 for making a national reality plain and involving in its delivery the black troops he praised, says David S. Reynolds, author of Abe, Abraham Lincoln in His Times. For those whose Juneteenth story does not put black people at its center, consider that there's no evidence that Granger ever spoke about his role in freeing Texas' estimated 250,000 slaves. But black people have kept telling the story, and each time that happens, Juneteenth is created anew. Here's a short column entitled Short Reads. Give healthcare workers a shot. For moral, humanitarian, and practical reasons, the U.S. should commit to vaccinating the world's healthcare workers, writes Dr. Ashish K. Shah, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Does the U.S. really have this many doses to spare? Absolutely. When visibility is not enough, President Biden has taken some actions to protect LGBTQ rights, but activist Raquel Willis says not much has changed for the majority of the trans community. Anytime we enter a new political era, groups on the margins are told to be patient, temper our expectations, demand less, or feel grateful for making it as far socially as we have today. An alarming sign of the times. If you were shocked by Michael Flynn's call for a military coup, you have not been paying attention, write U.S. Representatives Jason Crow and Chrissy Houlihan. Let us be clear. This assault on democracy is as intentional as it is insidious. Here are a few very short book reviews. My Heart is a Chainsaw, by Stephen Graham Jones, at once an homage to the horror genre and a searing indictment of the brutal legacy of indigenous genocide in America, Stephen Graham Jones' My Heart is a Chainsaw delivers both dazzling thrills and visceral commentary. Protagonist Jade Daniels, a Native American girl in Idaho, finds refuge from her turbulent home life and her outcast status among her peers in slasher films. Her love of the gloriously gory collides with reality when harrowing incidents begin happening in her small town. But physical carnage is not the only casualty in the novel. Jones takes grief, gentrification, and abuse to task in a tale that will terrify you and break your heart at the same time. Seeing Ghosts by Kat, K-A-T, Chow, C-H-O-W. Kat Chow dares to explore the lingering dynamics of her family's shared grief in her breathtaking debut memoir, Seeing Ghosts. Born 2 years after her parents' only son died shortly after birth, Chow has always had a preternatural fixation on death. one that only intensifies when her mother unexpectedly dies of cancer during Chow's adolescence. As she trudges through life in a haze of grief, Chow looks to the past to see how three generations of her family, spanning four countries, have coped with immeasurable loss. It is a bittersweet meditation on how losing the ones we love indelibly shapes the futures of the living, and how we ultimately find healing in the strength of family. Those two titles are due to be published in August, as well as this next one, The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, by Morris Carlos Ruffin, R-U-F-F-I-N. The author of We Cast a Shadow sets his new short story collection in his native New Orleans. Morris Carlos Ruffin brings us narratives that range deftly in subject and scope from a story exploring the unexpected kindness exchanged between an army vet and a runaway teen to a flash fiction piece about a group of men attempting to access an elderly man's home during Hurricane Katrina. Throughout these stories, Ruffin highlights experiences both specific and universal about people living on the margins, all while capturing the culture and spirit of New Orleans. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.